Well, hello there, and welcome back to our Revelation podcast study. My name is John Cordray. I'm pastor here at Trinity Klein, and we're so glad that you joined us for our continued walkthrough through this incredible visionary book that is often avoided by Christians because it's complex and hard to understand and maybe even frightening at times. And we're hoping that as we walk through some of the more frightening pieces of this book in the middle of it, that we will get rid of some of the scary stuff and make sure that we have a good understanding of where this book is heading and why we have this book in the first place. Because Revelation is not about just being scary. It's actually more about bringing hope to Christians rather than fear. So we are picking up in Revelation chapter 13. And just kind of a little bit of review. Chapter 12, we got to see for the first time the full spiritual battle that is taking place in the book of Revelation and really throughout the entire church age, which consists of the time from Jesus' ascension all the way until his return. And so in chapter 12, we got all the action that happens with Satan, and known as the dragon, the red dragon. And we got to see him attack the Messiah and fail to destroy him. We got to see him attack the church and try and undermine the foundation of the church, and he failed in that. So then at the end of chapter 12, he turns his attention to the individuals. The way that the book of Revelation puts it is that he turns his attention and attacks towards the offspring of the woman, which is the church. Those are the individuals of the church. So it's something, you know, that's kind of interesting about the book of Revelation is the visionary pieces. And chapter 13, as we move into it, really gives us that visionary piece, the apocalyptic feel, as the dragon turns his attacks towards the individuals, Christians. And the way he does that is actually through two beasts that he conjures up. It's not so much that he goes full on direct attack against individual Christians, but rather he uses means by which to attack them, known as the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth. So let's get into the text of chapter 13, Revelation. Here we go. Verse 1 says, "The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. People worshiped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worshiped the beast and asked, 'Who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it?' The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and exercise its authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. It was given power to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. And it was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, the Lamb who was slain from the creation of the world. Whoever has ears, let them hear. If anyone is to go into captivity they will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword they will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of God's people." So a lot there to unpack for sure, and I wanted to kind of give you the whole picture of this beast of the sea. He's a critical figure in the book of Revelation, and he will continue to show up throughout the following chapters. So again, at the end of chapter 12, the dragon of the abyss stands at the edge of the sea, ready to conjure these two new beasts, one from the sea itself and one from the earth. And the sea for Israel represented chaos and evil. It was a scary place. And so out of the sea came a terrifying beast, right? Israel never really took full ownership of the land along the Mediterranean Sea. There's always Canaanites and Philistines and different groups of people that had also settled along the sea line, or seashore, I should say. So they never really became a seafaring people. And so the sea always kind of held this scary mystery. And you notice in a book like Jonah, you know, when Jonah's trying to get away from God, where does he go? He goes out into the sea because they viewed it as a place that, you know, was further away from God and represented the evil and the chaos of everything. Dr. Lewis Brighton in the Concordia Commentary Series writes this. He says, "The beast represents and symbolizes every human authority and everything of the human nature that the dragon can corrupt and control and use in his warfare against the woman, the church, and her seed, individual Christians. Political, governmental, social, economic, philosophical, and educational systems, as well as individuals." So this beast from the sea represents kind of this political beast of sorts. It really is captured in the political, governmental, social, economic, philosophical, and educational systems. That's a great description of it. And so it's going to wage war against the church and against the people of the church in that fashion. So verse 1, the 10 horns and the 7 heads, another reference to power and authority that the beast carries. So verse 1 says, "And I saw the beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name." Right? So these 10 horns and 7 heads seems identical to the way that the dragon of the abyss is pictured. This tells us that the authority and the power of the beast from the sea comes from Satan himself. So any authority and power that these political, we'll just call them political powers, has comes from Satan. Notice that on its horns sat royal crowns. This is a little different than the dragon of the abyss, whose crowns were on his head. The horns represent earthly powers, and the crowns on his heads tell us that the beast of the sea will have power on earth given to it by the dragon of the abyss. So the dragon has power and authority, and he gives it then to these earthly powers and authorities to wield and to utilize against the people of God and against the church. On its heads, it carried the name blasphemy. The head was considered the seat of intelligence. That's where your brain is. So that's where all your intelligence is. So the dragon is going to motivate the beast of the sea to carry out craftily devised schemes, right, against the people of God. This isn't going to be something that's necessarily always easy to spot, easy to see. The persecution, the attacks are going to come from these political, economic, and social constructs, and it's going to come against them in a way that sometimes will be very, very crafty and very shrewd. And so it's a warning to God's people to be on the lookout for these things, right? Verse 2, we pick up, "The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority." Now, to understand this part of the vision, you've got to know Daniel. The physical description of this beast finds similarity in the four beasts that emerge in Daniel's visions from Daniel chapter 7. You see, there in Daniel 7, he receives this vision, Daniel does, of four beasts, each representing a world superpower. And the first is Babylon, and it appears like that of a lion. The second is Persia, it comes as a bear. The third is a leopard, and this is representative of the superpower Greece. And then finally, you've got this mythical beast with 10 horns that represents Rome. Now, here in John's vision, what we see in the beast of the sea is a combination of all the four. He's got things that resemble a leopard, feet like those of a bear, mouth like that of a lion. It's got the 7 heads and the 10 horns that the mythical beast from Daniel 7 would have shared. So you get to see them all. Now notice also that here in Revelation, John sees them in reverse order. So we said that the first beast in Daniel was that of a lion, the second a bear, the third a leopard, and finally this mythical beast of a dragon. And here in John, it's the opposite. First, we see this beast come up out of the sea, and then it's described as resembling leopard, bear, and lion. And it's because John is looking at things back in time. Daniel saw it going moving forward, so it would have started with the Babylonian Empire in which he was living, which would have then been followed by Persia, Greece, and then Rome. John is living in Rome and looking back through time at these political beasts that have come up and will continue to come up to persecute and attack the people of God. Verse 3, it tells us that one of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. So one of the heads is mortally wounded, and yet it's healed. And this symbolizes that leaders and nations will rise to inflict pain, suffering, and persecution upon God's people. But no one nation or leader is going to last. That's the hence the mortal wound. They're going to come. They're going to pass on. But while they may die or fade away, they will always be replaced by another, hence the healed wound, right? Notice also how the whole world marvels at this beast and its power. It's impressive. And when you look at some of the world powers throughout the ages, you recognize that, yeah, they wielded a great power and authority on earth. And again, all of that comes from Satan, that power and authority, because they're going to use that power against God's people. So verse 4 then picks up, people worship the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worship the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? So whenever people actually engage in formal worship of the state or its leaders, or when they place their hope and trust in human institutions and affairs and resort to them in place of God, what they're actually doing is exactly what Revelation says here. They are worshiping the dragon because he encourages such idolatry. So it says the whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast, and people worshiped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worshiped the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? So whenever we place our trust in the state, the power of the state, over and above the power of God, we commit idolatry, right? Plain and simple. First commandment is you shall have no other gods above Yahweh God, above Jesus. And the reality is when we place our hope, our faith, our trust in the state over and above God, that's exactly what we've done. And we end up worshiping this beast of the sea. And because we worship the beast of the sea, whose power and authority comes from Satan, inadvertently we also end up worshiping Satan behind it, so following him. And again, behind every idol, behind every ounce of idolatry stands Satan, just loving it when God's people find themselves caught up in idolatry and worshiping something other than God himself. In verse 5, it says that the beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and exercise its authority for 42 months. Now that 42 months pops up again. We heard it in chapter 12 as part of the era of, actually it goes back to chapter 11, if my memory serves me right. But either way, it goes back to this era of the church from the time that Christ ascends into heaven to the time that he returns. So during these 42 months, this era of the church, the political beast is going to be on the prowl and at work with Satan behind it. It will be mouth utter proud words and blasphemies and exercise its authority. Verse 6, it says, it opened its mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. It was given power to wage war against God's holy people, right, and to conquer them, and it was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. So the dragon of the sea is allowed to wage war upon people, but especially God's people. So it's not just God's people who are going to suffer under the authority and power of the state. In fact, it's all people that in some way will suffer, but in particular God's people. And in its warfare, this political beast is going to set out to conquer and destroy God's holy people by subverting their faith and outlawing their witness to the Lamb. As the beast exercises authority over all nations, God's people then will become isolated and tormented until Christ's return. And if you just look back in history of the Christian church, there have been seasons and times in history where authorities and states have risen up to silence the Christian church. You have cases of such as, USSR and the communist regimes there. You've got situations with Nazi Germany. You've got situations in China, North Korea, various places where religious freedom in particular is not just hampered, but completely limited. And religion is they try to actually tamp it out and get rid of it, claiming that it is evil in and of itself. And so this political state comes in and fights against the testimony of the Christian church and its witness to the Lamb. And the beast exercises authority over all these nations. And so for those Christians that happen to live in these nations, they will slowly become more isolated and unfortunately more tormented until Christ's return, which helps us understand why in the beginning of the book of Revelation with the letters, there's such a cry to faithfulness and endurance, because this is what the people are going to endure for thousands of years until Christ's return. So then in verse 8, it says, "All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all those whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, the Lamb who was slain from the creation of the world." And we get this little bit of last kind of call. It says, "Whoever has ears, let them hear. If anyone is to go into captivity, they will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword they will be killed." This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on God's part, right? So it's a little quote from the book of Jeremiah, chapter 15, verse 2, that John pulls into this vision. And here in the midst of this war, there is still hope offered to the people of God. For those whose names are written in the book of life, they are those that God loves and continues to be mindful of. And at the end of Revelation, those in the new creation are the ones whose names are written in the book of life. So the encouragement is to hear these words and to help encourage the Christian to heed the warnings of the vision in the book of Revelation and to stay true to God rather than give in to this nationally powered beast who Satan controls. And it ends with that call for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of God's people. Now, one of the interesting connections, again, to the book of Daniel, because these two books have a lot of things similar to each other, is that in Daniel, there's a clear antichrist that comes, and his job is to subvert the worship of God's people. And we're going to hear more about that a little bit when we get to the beast of the earth. But the way that Antichrist does it in the book of Daniel is he slowly wears God's people down. And I think that's the way that Satan works. He doesn't come in one fell swoop in a weekend and wipe everything out. He just wears you down with temptations. He saddles you with fear and doubt. And what Christ does, he comes in and he strengthens you with that patient endurance and faithfulness, and he dispels the fear. First John tells us that, perfect love casts out all fear, and he dispels the doubt. Instead, he gives us confidence in our faith to stand true, to stand faithful to him in the midst of battling this beast of the sea. So then we get to the beast of the earth. And it begins in verse 11. It says, "Then I saw a second beast coming out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon." And immediately, I'm going to pause there. Immediately, we see what a difference this beast is compared to the beast of the sea, right? It's described as having two horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. Verse 12, it says, "It exercised all the authority of the first beast on its behalf, and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. And it performed great signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to the earth in full view of the people. Because of the signs it was given power to perform on behalf of the first beast, it deceived the inhabitants of the earth. It ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. The second beast was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast, so that the image could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. It also forced all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands or on their foreheads, so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. That number is 666, dun, dun, dun. And now we get the scary part of Revelation, right? We get the mark of the beast, the 666. And there's so much in pop culture and pop Christianity about this mark of the beast and the 666 that really is just not based in Scripture. And so we're going to sort some of that out here. So again, from the Concordia Commentary series, Dr. Brighton writes these words. He says, "While the beast of the sea, which is outside the usual realm of humanity, represents external oppression that forces its dominating tyrannical rule upon people and thus enslaves them, the beast of the earth and what it represents works from within and among people, springing up from humanity's own native soil, as it were. The beast from the earth does not force itself upon people, but rather insinuates itself into their confidence and then leads them astray." So the beast from the sea kind of rises up external to people and is an external force coming upon the people. But the beast of the earth coming up from where the people live is part of the people, so to speak. So verse 11 introduces us to it. And like I said before, it's a really distinct kind of description that we're given. The beast from the earth emerges with this deceptive nature, as it looks like a lamb with its horns, but rather it speaks like a dragon. This beast represents the religious tyranny, the false religions, the religious attacks that will come upon God's people. It wants to look like Jesus, the lamb, but it speaks like Satan, like the dragon. Right? So it's all the false religions, false spiritualities that are out there. This guy leads all those and presses them, and presses people into a religious or false religious beliefs. So then verse 12, it says that it exercised all the authority of the first beast on its behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. And verse 13, it performed great signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to the earth in full view of people. And because of the signs, it was given power to perform on behalf of the first beast. It deceived the inhabitants of the earth. It ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. So the second beast assists the first beast in inspiring people to worship him. So this religious beast comes along and he entices people to worship the political beast. At the same time, this religious beast, the second guy, is described as being able to produce great signs and wonders. And this indicates that this beast falls into the category of a false prophet. There were some through the Old Testament, New Testament, who could produce certain signs and wonders that actually misled people. So understand that there were moments in history where false prophets could do some pretty miraculous and kind of crazy things, and that would lead people astray, and that's exactly what this second beast of the earth is going to do. It causes idolatry of the first beast, and it gives life to that idolatry. It's what it means when in verse 15 it says the second beast was given power to breathe power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that the image could speak and cause all who refuse to worship the image to be killed. This authority to cause worship can even, like it says, be used to put to death those who refuse to worship. And if you go in the Old Testament, a great example of exactly what this looks like, it's very blatant, is in the book of Daniel in Babylon. When I believe it's King Nebuchadnezzar sets up a statue of himself and says, "Worship this statue, otherwise you're going to die. And of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refuse to bow down to the statue and are thrown into the fiery furnace. But God saves them from the furnace. And it's kind of this incredible moment of God's faithfulness to his people, even in the midst of their exile. Verse 16 then tells us, it also forced all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands or on their foreheads, so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. And so this mark of the beast that is put onto people identifies them as those who follow the beast. Now, no description is offered on how it is applied. Now, I've heard rumors, I've heard theories that tattoos are the way to go when it comes to the mark of the beast, that all those who receive tattoos are receiving in some fashion the mark of the beast. Nowadays, actually a couple of years ago, I have to say, there was this sense that the mark of the beast was going to come through microchips. Now it's through vaccines because of COVID-19. There's all kinds of different theories about what this mark is actually going to be. Now, here's the reality. Whether or not this is a physical mark is something that we have to question, because there's really no description on their right hands and on their foreheads. But we also understand that Revelation is a very symbolic book. It could be, a many things in combination together that shows a person's allegiance to the beast and its influence upon them. It may not be one thing that pulls it all together and says, oh, okay, you got this mark. Here's the spiritual meaning behind it all. This is the anti-baptism. In the same way that God marks us in baptism with a spiritual sign, so too does Satan mark his followers with a spiritual sign. Okay, so he marks people the same way that Christ marks us in our baptism. It's just the very opposite of what Christ is doing. In verse 18, we're told that this number is 666, and it represents a number of things. First off, it's a representation of what we would call the unholy trinity, which we have been introduced to. You've got the dragon of the abyss, the beast from the sea, and the beast from the earth. This is the unholy trinity, right? And it is also, this 666 is also the anti-Shema, as it's placed in the same location. So the Shema was a confession of faith coming out of the Old Testament, that God was one, and he was the only God. And they were told to put it on your forehead. And it was to wear this this statement of faith. And so this becomes the anti-Shema in the case of those who worship the beast, right? So it's also one other thing, a cryptogram or a hidden code. Now, let me pause you before you go crazy on the hidden codes in Revelation. This is the only place where we can really grab hold of this idea of a secret message, so to speak. And here's how it works. If you take the name Nero Caesar, who happened to be the ruler during John's time, and change it to Hebrew, and then using the numerical numbers that are assigned to each of the Hebrew letters, it adds up to the number 666. Okay? So then you got to go, okay, what's the message that John is trying to share by doing this? This number or mark points to a leader who typified the beasts. That would be Nero Caesar, right? He's kind of the greatest example in John's time of what these two beasts together represent. And it pointed to, the anti-Shema, the anti-baptism, and finally, the unholy trinity. So who stands behind Nero Caesar? The beast of the sea and the beast of the earth that Satan has conjured up to fight his battles for against God's people. And later on in Revelation, we're going to discover that Satan's power has been limited by God. And so he doesn't necessarily have the power to attack Christians directly. Rather, he has to do it indirectly. And that's why Satan conjures up these two beasts, the political and the religious beast. Now, for the rest of the book of Revelation, we're going to be seeing these two beasts pop up. It'll always be the political beast, and he's always going to look the same. But that beast from the earth, that religious beast, he's going to come up two more times, but he's going to change his shape. In fact, as he changes his shape, he's going to get more enticing, more attractive, and try and lead more people away. So at first he comes up and, you know, he's got the horns of a lamb and doesn't look too scary, but speaks like a dragon, still pretty frightening, called a beast. He's going to then pop up again as a false prophet, which does signs and wonders. We've already heard a little bit about that, but it's going to come in a little bit more in the next few chapters. And then finally, this religious beast is going to show up as a harlot or a prostitute, dressed in all kinds of nice clothes and jewelry to try and entice people, God's people, away from God. Well, that's the end of Revelation chapter 13. Introduces us to two big characters of the book, and we're going to see how they're going to work throughout the rest of Revelation as it unfolds. Once again, thank you for joining us. If you have any comments, thoughts, questions on this chapter, please feel free to email me at cordrej@trinitycline.org. That's cordrej@trinitycline.org. It was great to have you with us.